Unitarian Universalism unquestionably belongs in that category called liberal religion. You may be a member or a friend who has been around for a while. You may be a visitor or a relative newcomer. You may be here to check us out in a suspicious manner. For whatever reason we are here, though, every one of us in this room knows that we are sitting in a hotbed of liberal religion. We may find ourselves frustrated by the category sometimes, but we are in it willy-nilly. There is a 2005 book, this one right here, called Restless Souls by Lee Eric Schmidt. Elton Hall and I are teaching a class on it starting in a week or so. And it unabashedly lifts up religious liberalism as one of America's most significant historical or religious streams, a source, he says, of much that is good in our country. This is a good book for Unitarian Universalists to read, since Unitarians have been central to the American liberal religious movement since it began in the early 19th century, although it can scarcely be called a movement. Think of how hard it is for us to gather into any kind of cohesive group about anything. If I were to ask you, what is liberal religion? What would you say? I'm not asking you a rhetorical pulpit question. I'm asking you to reflect for yourself what values, attitudes, and imperatives are involved in liberal religion. I am asking you to get personal as you reflect on the religious values dear to you. I live every day of my life with tensions, questions, and issues that arise from our being who we are, and I'll bet a lot of you do too. We want to be as vigorously affirmative about our faith as Schmidt is about liberal religion in general, and it's not always easy. Last week, I got a fortune cookie whose message was, "You would prosper in the field of wacky inventions." So after my lunch companions, members of this church, and I had stopped laughing, we agreed that liberal religion may indeed be a wacky invention. The book Restless Souls has ironically caused me to reflect more deeply than usual about the possible pitfalls of our wacky invention. And I'm going to ask you to reflect along with me once we do a little defining. For your heart and your life, what is liberal religion? What is Unitarian Universalism? Schmidt lists 6 points that he calls the rudiments of it. See if you agree with him. Individual aspiration after mystical experience or religious feeling. You think Ralph Waldo Emerson and that strange phrase of his when he said, "I became a transparent eyeball as one with God and my surroundings." Schmidt's second point is the valuing of silence and solitude and serene meditation. Think Henry David Thoreau. "I love to be alone. I never found the companion who was quite so companionable as solitude." Schmidt's third one is the immanence of the transcendent, or in regular people's language, the holy in everything. Quaker George Fox said, "There is that of God in everyone." Modern-day creation spirituality people say there is God, that of God in everyone and in everything. His fourth point is the appreciation of religious variety as well as unity. And we can think of our 19th century forefather, James Freeman Clark, who in the early 19th century helped found Harvard Divinity School's Comparative Religion Department. And he wrote a two-volume book called 10 Great Religions at a time when this was not being done. The fifth one is the pursuit of justice-producing reforms. That's part of liberal religion. We might think of Barack Obama in 2004 when he had recently been elected as senator. He says, it shouldn't be hard to reconnect progressive politics with religious vision. Martin Luther King did it. The abolitionists did it. Dorothy Day did it. We don't have to start from scratch. And his sixth point is an emphasis on creative self-expression and adventuresome seeking. I think of Garrison Keillor's characterization of us as starting churches through creative dance. Now, you may not agree with all of these for Unitarian Universalists, but they are true for the movement of liberal religion in America. And if we take a glance at our Unitarian Universalist principles, we'll find a little more emphasis on community since we are, in fact, creating and maintaining congregations. Acceptance of one another, encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, affirmation of the democratic process, world community, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Now, most of us who identify with Unitarian Universalism will pretty much agree with Schmidt and with our principles. There are many paths to the whole. The supremacy of the individual in finding truth and meaning. How many times have you heard or perhaps said the phrase spiritual but not religious, meaning individual but not institution? Boy, I hear that all the time. We also know that understanding of truth changes as we travel our path. We believe in the pursuit of justice in the world and a sense of interdependence or being part of the larger whole. So if these principles are true, what are the questions that arise in our minds and our hearts? And they don't just arise in our minds and hearts either. Our critics bring them up all the time. How can there be any depth or cohesiveness in a faith where we get to believe whatever we want to believe? How wacky is it to have an alleged church that has self-described atheists in it? Since we don't communally engage the same theological issues in our dogmas, how can we be anything but shallow dilettantes and latte liberals? Can a religion with so much individual variation among its adherents ever really nurture the souls of those who come into its doors? Can it ever really help heal the world? Well, it won't surprise you to know that after this particular round of soul searching, I return again to a joyful affirmation of the path that we tread. Tensions, discomfort, and awe. Without abandoning the almost painful sense of ambiguity and paradox that surrounds our way of being religious, I can preach religious liberalism with joy, and I can use my preacher's prerogative to exhort us to certain practices. Let me get one thing out of the way first, though. You can't believe anything you want, and we should simply stop saying that. We cannot believe, for instance, that we have the one answer for all people if we follow our value of respect for all. As intellectually and even morally superior as we sometimes act, our respect for other individuals denies us that luxury. If we should join a white supremacist group believing in the superiority of one category of human beings over another, we would cease to be UUs. If we believe that an authoritarian means is okay in the service of a compassionate end, we are false to our principle of the right of conscience and the democratic process. You get the picture. We can't believe anything we want to. Don't let anybody tell you that. So having gotten that out of my system, let me share with you three practices that can save liberal religion from fragmentation and navel-gazing. Without all three, we accede to our critics and to our own internal critiques. The first one is honoring relationship and community. This means holding the tension between our first principle, which is respect for the individual, and our seventh principle, which is the interdependent web of all existence. It means sometimes putting community over your own good, and it means contributing to community. It means holding compassion as a high guide, refraining from hurtful word and deed, even when we know each other well enough to really put the knife into that tender spot. And in community, we will. It means following Jesus' admonition to love our neighbor as ourselves. It means understanding that love and respect trump belief systems in any liberal religious group of people. Over my 21 years of serving this fellowship, there have always been people who disagree vigorously with my theistic, spiritual approach to the world. Some have even been offended by it, and most of them have gone somewhere else. But many of those folks and I think most, have moved past the differences that would be deal breakers in a non-wacky religion. Many of us have moved into respect and even into love. In August, there was a senior sages breakfast potluck at the home of Chuck and Dorothy Hansen, very long-term members of our church. The senior sages group contains perhaps the greatest concentration, besides the humanist group, the greatest concentration of humanists, atheists, and anti-spiritualists in and around our church. A few of them still take a pretty dim view of me. You got to admire that persistence, you know? You really do. But you know, as I joined them, as I sat and broke bread with them in the Hansons' lovely backyard, it just didn't matter. It didn't seem to matter to any of us. As we relaxed, we ate, we teased each other about our points of view, we discussed politics, whatever. I'm pretty sure that Chuck Hansen and I are 180 degrees different in our beliefs on matters of a spiritual nature. But as I was leaving, and we hugged with the enormous affection that we share, theology or philosophy was the furthest thing from our hearts. And as I walked to my car, tears rose unbidden, and I wept with a mysterious joy that was deeper and higher than belief. As foundational as relationship and community are, they are not sufficient to make a genuinely liberally religious congregation. The second practice that will save us from shallowness and stereotypical new aginess is each of us taking responsibility for our own spiritual discipline. Doing it day in and day out. The reading that Pam read to us from the book Restless Souls was by, as she said, Felix Adler, humanist champion of the early 20th century. He founded the Ethical Cultural Society, which is a mecca to this day for American humanists. He alarmed Jews and Christians alike when he appeared on the intellectual scene because they feared he was willing to slough off any and all religious practice in the name of progress. Adler was a fierce social reformer and critic of all that dimmed the human spirit. And he fiercely advocated a deep spiritual practice for all. He says, on the ground of mental sanity and on the ground of spirituality, those are his words, he declared a regular spiritual discipline absolutely necessary for the progressive person committed to the betterment of humanity. And he was right. If we who use have a besetting sin in practicing our faith, it is ignoring our spiritual underpinnings. As Adler pointed out, our daily reflections may be based on any inspirational system. We can follow Buddhist teachings and practices. We can do ethical cultural ideals, Emersonian mysticism, Christian-centering prayer, Zen emptiness, movement practices. We may read and ponder thoughtful philosophical discourse. It is not dilettantism if each of it does it every day. For a daily practice takes us deep. And such practices give us a shared commitment to the mystery that we'll never know, and they ground us toward our better selves. There's a little tension in the air at the moment. Let's take a deep breath, okay? Let yourself recenter here. It can even be 10 minutes a day, you know. Another deep breath. Feeling ourselves present, mindfully in this place. If we all practiced a regular spiritual discipline, we'd also deflect the common critique that we're shallow and we never wrestle with the existential difficulties of life. A regular discipline takes us deep into our shadow selves, not the prettiest parts of our beings. True spiritual practice requires that we do the hard work at looking at ourselves and learning to be better people. For what it's worth, it's that fact that gives me the most empathy with all of you who don't want to practice. I do practice. And sometimes I purely hate what I have to face. But on a cheerier note, a deep and regular practice also keeps us from denying life's pain, for it does give us strength and courage to go on. Okay, finally, the third practice that will make us a coherent and joyful liberal religious community is a commitment to social justice. We honor each other. That's very important. We deepen our community by paying attention to our religious taproots, and then we walk our talk, and we look outward to the hunger and the poverty and the narrow-mindedness and the oppressions that create this world's injustices. If we only follow those first two practices, we will be narcissists, not committed in any other way, in any way to other people. So each of us will live our lives in our own individual outreaching way, and we all do. We also must commit to social justice as a religious community. Think of the difference we make simply by giving 25% of our morning offering to a certain cause every month. That's a pretty small thing. Do you remember the bright faces of the kids in the Boise Urban Gardens program? They did a joyful Sunday service for us this summer. Reflect on what our church's Pay It Forward Fund means to the financially strapped member or friend who is facing the prospect of no utilities. Recall the gratitude and humor of Amy Herzfeld, who spent part of her childhood in this very church, as she thanked us on behalf of the Anne Frank Human Rights Education Center. As we mature in this area, as we make more resources available, It is the vision of many of us that we, the Boise Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, become a beacon for good causes and for systemic social justice. So, what do we think? A sermon like this can so easily run the risk of sounding theoretical, you know, like the characteristics of historical liberal religion and the pitfalls therein, and how to get out of them. But it's anything but theoretical. If we can all, in life's typically winding and indirect ways, flow toward a shared vision, we will be spiritually and socially vibrant as individuals and as a congregation. Can we wear the mantle of liberal religion proudly, committed to our higher power, to each other, to the larger good, and to creating just systems? In the Hebrew scriptures, the prophet Micah tells us we are to act justly, love kindness, and walk humbly with our God. It sounds like a fine foundation to me for our liberal religious endeavor. Let's give it a try.